My answer, I'm going to mitigate it a little bit. One is I wouldn't do that. The problem is you have an expert panel talking about use of these compounds. The problem is that out in the real world, there are a lot of 78-year-old guys who are 13 years after their prostatectomy who got treated with ADT, in my judgment, inappropriately for a slowly rising PSA, never going to die of disease. Now, 5 years later, have biochemical progression in the castrate setting, never going to die of disease, but are going to get these drugs because they hear people say, well, you know, so what they're not hearing is the high-risk features of the folks that my colleagues are treating. They're hearing this is, and the problem is there are a lot more of those than there are these. And so I want to see data in the non-metastatic patients. As the good Dr. Smith pointed out, we have no idea about long-term exposure. And we're talking about the natural history of 5 and 8 and 10 and 12 and 13 years. And when are we going to stop these drugs? So I'm a little worried about a slippery slope here.
Very good point. William?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real issue is most of us understand we want to be data-driven, but there's a lot of places in medicine where there's just no data to support it. Biologically, it makes a lot of sense to take a 50-year-old man who has metastatic disease, early castration resistance, asymptomatic, maybe no metastatic disease, and consider adding a drug like enzalutamide to his primary hormonal therapy. But there's just no evidence to tell us if that's both safe and effective. So would I consider it in a setting like that I just described? I think the patients bring it to us. They say, if this drug works in the setting of metastatic castration-resistant disease, why wait if you know that I'm going to become castration-resistant in the very near future or even in a few years? And I think that's a compelling argument from their perspective. I think the real issue is that until we have a broader safety profile, until we get out of the clinical trial and into the real world, until we, even as academic investigators, have more experience with this drug in various disease settings and various types of patients, it's hard to make that recommendation off the bat. But over time, I think people will certainly want to see the clinical trials, but also have more comfort with the drugs.
Oliver?
Well, you know, I love being in this data-free zone. I mean, you know, we can just imagine anything. First thing is, going back to what Rob said, I think it's absolutely true that a lot of people just have a little slow rise. Even when they're castrate-resistant, they do not progress very rapidly. The data sets that Matthew has published on, you know, has been able to bring forth a certain criteria of patients, PSA above X, doubling time less than X, and it's a little bit of a different subset of patients. So I might even introduce a concept that is totally weird and non-data supported, and that is intermittent use of these agents. I worry a lot about the side effects of long-term extreme androgen deprivation, sarcopenia, muscle weakness. It's real. And when you get these patients who've been on, particularly elderly, for a long period of time on extreme androgen deprivation, they're showing effects of that androgen deprivation. They're weaker, they're fatigued, they're not exercising as much. It'd be great if we could get them all to exercise. They don't. They probably sit at the table and eat a little more. They gain a little more weight, exercise less. It's not all good quality of life.
Tom, how low will you go?
I think I'd be very careful. I mean, first of all, as I think has been alluded to, I'd risk stratify these patients to make sure they need any kind of treatment, no matter what it is. And if I decided that they needed treatment today, I would still lean towards the agents that we've used before, like bicalutamide or even ketoconazole. I don't know what the long-term side effects of these agents are. I'm a little more worried about abiraterone because the prednisone component becomes more and more, in my view, important, and we're talking about 5 years of therapy in this setting potentially. Enzalutamide may not have that issue, but we don't know very much about the long-term side effects. What I've noticed recently is that while the paper reports seizures in 0.6% of patients, the FDA-approved prescribing information says 0.9%. I don't know what that's about, whether that's additional follow-up and a couple more patients, but here again, we would be proposing potentially years and years of therapy. Is that 1% a year? I don't know. But that would become, I think, potentially important in the setting where the risk from the disease is pretty modest. So the bottom line is today, I think I would be rather conservative about the use of these agents.
One of the most common remarks we get about our programs is that people feel so reassured when they see investigators struggle. Because they're out there struggling, trying to figure out what to do. They think that you all know the answers when they hear that you don't. It's very informative to them. Dan?
You know, one of the reasons why Labrie's theory about combined androgen blockade did not initially pan out is we had very poor antiandrogens. You know, bicalutamide was really not an optimal antiandrogen. Same thing with flutamide. Same thing with nalutamide. Now we have better agents. And I think according to what has been said by Tom and Oliver and everybody else, is that we may see a greater spectrum of side effects with complete androgen blockade or complete shutdown. Particularly, some of these studies have indicated neuropsychiatric changes over time, and they may not have been consistently reported because the androgen blockade may not have been as complete as we're seeing now. Same thing with seizures. Remember, too, that the average time that patients were on enzalutamide is about 6 months. You're talking now about years on enzalutamide, which may actually change your spectrum of side effects. So I would be very, very cautious outside of a clinical trial.
Matt, how do you answer your own question?
So my view most closely mirrors the comments made by Dr. Dreiser. If we don't like the long-term side effects of ADT, we may like the safety of long-term exposure to abiraterone and or enzalutamide less. It's a question that needs to be prospectively studied. We can comfortably generalize from post-chemo to pre-chemotherapy because both groups of patients will almost certainly die of disease. Not the case as we move earlier and earlier. In even high-risk non-metastatic CRPC, the median survival is 4 or 5 years. Many of those deaths are unrelated to cancer. And what we've learned from the NCIC Protocol 7 trial is that the majority of patients with PSA-only failure after radiation or surgery die of other causes. So we really have to be very careful about understanding the issue of competing risks. I would not comfortably generalize the data in metastatic CRPC to non-metastatic disease or even earlier, except in perhaps the unusual case, and this again mirrors Rob Dreiser's comments. Those are the exceptions and not the rules.